is episode number 203 of Play by Playcast, the podcast about play by play broadcasters for play by play broadcasters, hosted by a play by play broadcaster, professional development podcast that dives into the tips, tricks, experience, stories, process, and preparation of some of the biggest and best play by play announcers in the business. My name is Joel Godet, and our guest today is a guy that would know the fact that I stole that thematic of an intro from The Art of Wrestling with Colt Cabana, because his name is Alex Del Barrio. He has worked for WWE before. We will talk about it, but you might know him now as a play-by-play voice from CBS Sports Network, among other places. What's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Just wrapped up a college basketball season. We're wrapping up, getting things going with the tournament, and it's been fun to kind of sit on my couch and actually enjoy the tournament from beginning to end for the first time in a while. So I'm excited to be here, man. And by the way, Colt's still waiting for his check. On that.
Yeah, we don't make money off this podcast yet. So. it's a tough hit. You've got an awesome kind of backstory though in terms of how you got to where you are, because you did the local news thing until very recently. National television broadcasting, play-by-play, local play-by-play. You've done a lot of stuff down in Texas. But also you spent some time with WWE and you spent some time with the Harlem Globetrotters traveling the world as well, which is really awesome. If you can take me all the way back, like how did you plot your path? What was, when you sat down and said, I'm going to be a broadcaster, how did you attack it? And I guess, how did that align with how things wound up working out?
Yeah, I have one of the most eclectic, resumes, I think, of anyone I know in this business. And I'm very grateful and blessed to have kind of accomplished like seven different people's childhood dreams along the way. And it's so cool to have done it. But to take you back, you know, I got into sports kind of a little bit later. I actually was into pro wrestling way before I was into sports. Fell in love with WWE right around 8, 9, 10 years old. I think I told this story on WWE.com as well. Like, I still remember the first Monday Night Raw I ever watched. It was that vivid of a memory for me. And you know, I knew that once I got into high school and stuff and I was getting into sports and I was playing basketball, and basketball was my first love, that I wanted to be involved in sports kind of somehow. And it just so happened that I was taking like an information technology class in my freshman year of high school. And one of the semesters we did a project on DJing, where you actually had to DJ like music and stuff. And it didn't make any sense with the rest of the curriculum in the class, but I got into it, and I did more of a sports show than a music show. And then we did a charity basketball game that year with like the local news folks and against our coaches. And I was like the play-by-play announcer, or the PA announcer, I should say. And I was doing it just like Ray Clay did with the Bulls, you know, cause that was, I was growing up right around the time when the Bulls were in their heyday, and everybody remembers that their iconic entrances, cause the NBA and NBC would actually show the starting lineups, you know? And so I did it that way. And that's how it kind of all started. And I tell this story, it's kind of funny. And anybody who played sports in high school, this is kind of a nerdy story, but I was on the junior varsity basketball team as a junior. And I broke my teeth. Like I dove for a ball, broke my teeth. So I was out for the season, and I couldn't play. So I asked the varsity coach if I could do the starting lineups. And sure enough, he let me do it kind of hesitantly. And then I did such a good job, he's like, he had me do the rest of the game. So I was actually on the JV in uniform, like announcing the game for our varsity. And they the next year when I was on the varsity, I would still do the starting lineups.
It's like Will Ferrell
on the
starting
bench,
exactly. Guard. Yes. Me.
Yeah, it was a very semi-pro thing for me, but that's kind of where it all started. And I think being at events was kind of my thing. Like, I think I first thought I wanted to be on SportsCenter, like as an anchor, because that was like the heyday of the Big Show with Keith and Dan. And but when I started like going to games more and experiencing that, I knew that I wanted to sit courtside and be involved in the action some way. And that's why I went to Boston U, because I knew I would get a chance to do some student radio stuff, in a big sports market in a big city. And that's kind of where it all stemmed from. But I always wanted to be involved somehow in the action, whether it was being a ring announcer in the middle of the ring for boxing or pro wrestling, whether it was sitting courtside and calling the game, or just even being a PA announcer. That's where it all kind of started for me. He was kind of 10, 11 years old, and then it just kind of blossomed, and just things kind of evolved along the way. You know, a lot of pure dumb luck happened along the way.
I want to talk to you about wrestling. And I feel like half the people that listen to this podcast are like, oh, wrestling. First off, big fan. Second of all, I think from a broadcast standpoint, it's got to be a really interesting perspective into how you developed. Because, like, if I were to ask you who is the, like, most versatile or best broadcaster you've been around in your career, I feel like the answer is probably Michael Cole. Tell me what you learned by your time in WWE, and I guess how that guy in particular rubs off on you.
Yeah. So I just want to preface this. I had a very short cup of coffee. I had very much a Moonlight Graham experience in WWE, but it was the most wonderful 7 months I could have ever asked for, because I got a master's degree in not just broadcasting, but just in pro wrestling, like psyche, from being at NXT and sitting with coaches as they're trying to train these next generation of talent who many don't know anything about pro wrestling. And they're just kind of athletes that are kind of being thrust into this. So getting the basics of psychology and taking the step forward until they get to the finishing classes with Terry Taylor, and they're just trying to fine tune some things before they're ready for TV. And then on the broadcasting side, you know, Cole will always mention the fact that he's a fake broadcaster with a fake name, calling a fake sport, right? And in so many ways, it's true, because you're almost like playing an announcer, even if you are an announcer. And it's a really tough, like, mental place to kind of put yourself in, especially when you're training to do it, because you're in a booth and you've got like just a television screen in front of you. You know, we're all used to kind of doing this now post COVID, right? Where we've done games from home.
I was gonna say, it's funny how that worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. So that like helped me prepare for COVID, right? Because I was in a booth like all the time with either Tom Phillips or Corey Graves or Cole or King or whoever, when, you know, was trying to train to do it. I never got to actually do it on television, but I was still training for it. And it's just a matter of understanding storytelling and the way each match is kind of constructed. And once you understand, and I kind of like break the glass for a lot of people when they watch wrestling now, because I will point out, okay, that's what we call the shine. That's what we call the finish. That's what we call the cutoff. And they start to realize that every match that they watch has the exact same points along the way. And when you understand it and can see it before it actually happens, you start to be able to tell the story a little bit better, because you start to see things before they happen in terms of the framework. And when you know when something's going to happen, at least subconsciously, it helps you lay out the story a little bit better. You know, very much in my style and play-by-play, I like to anticipate the big moment, right? It's kind of the lead up to the big moment. Hockey play-by-play announcers are so good at this, because it's like preparing for the goal and the explosion, right? It's the lead up to the shot, to the goal, and then the layout, and then the punctuation. There's a lot of pro wrestling kind of into that. If you notice, there's a lot of layouts on counts. Like, bad play-by-play wrestling announcers will count 1, 2, 3. Good play-by-play announcers let the action happen, let the crowd say 1, 2, 3, and then punctuate after the victory or the kickout, you know? So there's just like little nuanced things that you kind of learn from Cole, and just sitting backstage with a headset on while, you know, in NXT, he produces the announcers, and, you know, he gets in their ear and we'll feed him a line here or there. If there's a storyline point that Hunter wants to make sure he gets in, Hunter will pop in and say something. There's a lot less of that now with Vince gone, but it's the understanding that we're all trying to do one thing, and that's get the people who are in the ring over, meaning we're trying to tell the two people, the two combatants, the four combatants, whoever's in the ring, get that story, whatever has been outlined by the talent office and the creative office, get that story over. It's not about us. It's not about getting our shtick in. It's about making sure that that story is told in the right way. And as I've come back into play-by-play in the real world, right, it's the same thing, except they're actual real stories that you have to tell, and trying to figure out a way where to insert them, because it's not scripted, right? So you have to find the place to insert them. And that's the big challenge, because the game doesn't always allow you the places to put those stories in.
I was like, how did you learn how to, I don't want to say craft a story, but like craft a story, when it's not scripted, And maybe how did the scripted approach of it help? I think one thing that happens a lot with especially younger play-by-play announcers, or especially people that are getting into television for the first time, A, it goes a lot faster in their mind, and mm-hmm. B, it's very hard to pick the right spots. How much did your exposure to that world help you understand pacing, timing, how to get your story in quickly, all of those types of things?
Yeah, I think for me, because I worked in minor league sports, a lot of times I wouldn't prep for my team, right? I think we're in a situation where, you know, when we're in the minor league sports, we're doing 1,000 different things, right? And including making our own game notes for the media and stuff. And we're around the team so much that we kind of know our team like subconsciously. So the whole prepping for a game, I've had to develop a lot later as I've done kind of national stuff. And I would say I'm still a work in progress when it comes to preparation. And one of the things I learned, especially my first year at CBS, is that, and the wording of what I'm about to say sounds weird, right? But I want you to kind of hear me out. I do think that there's a way that you can over prep because you'll tend to want to have 7 different stories for everyone on the roster and you don't get the meat of the best stories. I go back to, and it's funny because I just had an Akron game here at the end of the year. You're familiar with the MAC, and the Enrique Freeman story is one of my favorite stories. And my very first game at CBS, you were there. It was Ball State in Akron, and that's when I first learned about Enrique Freeman story. For those who don't know, Enrique Freeman went to Akron on an academic scholarship, went to an open tryout, grew 4 inches between his senior year of high school until his freshman year of college, then became an All-American, All-Conference Player of the Year guy in the MAC. And it's just the most unbelievable college basketball story to get no offers and to become Player of the Year in your league is just unbelievable. And he's going to play in the NBA. That was the first real meaty story I ever got to tell on television. And the first year I kind of told it, I mean, he was still kind of an up-and-coming player at the time. He was still right among the league leaders in the conference and rebounding, but it wasn't the player that he became this year. But I was been able to tell that Akron, that Enrique Freeman story multiple times over the course of my career. And I've always been able to add something to it because I ask him more, I go deeper into it. Because you can tell the same story, but if you tell the exact same story points over and over, it's not good. And the same thing like with wrestling, you have to reemphasize things in the story because if you didn't watch Raw 2 weeks ago, if you didn't watch SmackDown last week, or if you missed the Instagram promo that The Rock cut, right? You still have to bring those story points into the show that you're telling because you have to forward the story, but you can't forward a story unless you reestablish some of the story points to begin with. So I, you know, going back to your question on how it kind of fit in, I think that has helped me. And I think WWE kind of overdoes it sometimes. They kind of over dumb down the storytelling, especially, you know, 5-10 years ago, especially with Vince running things. I think it's a little more nuanced and under, you know, it's very much more subtle now, but it's still something that I kind of think about when I do stories now, because, you know, the people that are watching our games, aren't necessarily that you're going to have the fans of the teams that are watching, but you're also going to have just random college basketball junkies and just random people, especially the more important the game is, right? So telling little nuggets like that along the way, you still have to remember that not everyone knows who Enrique Freeman is. The Akron fans do, but maybe the Ball State fan who's watching their team on CBS Sports Network for the first time doesn't know and think that that's a cool story about the opposing team. So, you know, kind of on a roundabout way, I do think that there's elements of trying to find the moments and trying to make sure that you're telling the best stories and not just telling every story, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's always, you know, I think we take it for granted sometimes. You're like, oh, everybody that's watching this game has an interest in this game. The last time I saw you call a game, I was on a JetBlue flight, and there was a girl next to me watching Western Michigan and Akron, and there ain't no way she had any tie to either of those two teams. But we were watching the same thing, and I was like, oh, yeah, she's learning a lot right now. How did you advance the Enrique Freeman story? Like, walk me through that. If you see a guy multiple times, what are you digging at to, like, let's take this to step 3, 4, 5 every time I get another one of his games.
Yeah. So the first time I did it, it was more like I was kind of surprised by it. It was the first time I'd ever gone to a shoot around, you know, and, you know, Tim Doyle was an excellent first partner to have, because if there's anyone that can just get a coach in a place of just wanting to chat, it's Tim Doyle, sure. Right? Yeah. So he was a great first partner to have in that regard, because he made me feel loose. He made Coach Gross feel loose, and just kind of like was able to give us some more of that story. Cause you know, you read it in a game note, it's one thing, but it's to hear Coach talk about it and maybe give you some sort of an extra little nugget. Like, give me something, Coach, like, what did you see then? And what do you see now? What would you say how has his demeanor changed from when you first met him to now? So I think that first time it was about just saying how nonsensical it was to kind of pick someone out of the lunch line at the Akron cafeteria and basically put him on a Division I roster. And he was basically a scout team player. And now here he is as a starter. So that was the story then. You know, then, you know, I did the MAC semifinals the following year, right? And, you know, they were in the semis, and it was like he had become like this double-double machine. But he was still struggling with his offense and still, you know, different. He hadn't developed the offensive parts of his game yet. So it became more about, okay, can he take another step forward? Where are the things that he needs to work on his game? And then the story became more about how hard he works, in that he was this player 2 years ago when he arrived here as a scout team player. And now he's an all-league player and a defensive player of the year candidate. Then you get to, you know, I don't think I had an Akron game last year, but I had one this year. Then it became, here's a guy that went to NBA draft camps. So when we sat down with Enrique, I was like, what did you learn from that experience? Because he entered the draft and then came out, which is something that I think is great that guys can do now. So, you know, Enrique was still like, he got, you know, he's a longtime Cleveland Cavaliers fan. So he got to work out with the Cavs, which was a dream come true. And he told us how much that meant to him. And I said, what did you learn about that experience? He's like, I learned some of the aspects of my game that I needed to work on going into this season, that I'm not quite ready for that level, but I do have the skills to be at that level. Then you're talking to Coach Gross. Is what did that NBA draft practice experience mean to him for this year? How have you seen him be different? And he's like, well, you've seen him move his game out a little bit. He shoots more threes than he ever did. His court vision is a lot better in terms of trying to distribute. He's more aggressive in different ways on the glass, as opposed to, you know, just being a guy that reacts. He's more perceptive about where the ball may end up after a missed shot. So there were all kinds of these little things about his game, and you can start it all the way back from not being ever offered a scholarship to being the presumptive player of the year, which was when I got him on their last regular season game. And then talking about the whole run it back aspect of them having been in the tournament a couple of years ago, and then everyone coming back, Ali coming back from Butler to rejoin the team and then make a run and get to the NCAA tournament. It just became an all-encompassing story about Enrique Freeman's journey to player that wasn't draft, or there wasn't even considered a Division I player, to being a potential NBA draft player. So there were little nuggets you could add to the story along the way, but you can't tell the finished story of a kid going through the draft process without first telling the part where he wasn't even considered a Division I player.
That's a really good insight into preparation for people that want to get inside the mind of how you kind of grow and develop storylines
And Joel, the thing about this is, like, that's just the perfect story, right? To do. Not every story is going to be Enrique Freeman, and you have to find, you know, on every, and you're not going to find that Kevin Kugler type story. I forget the Jason Preston one, right? For some reason, these all end up being MAC players, which I think is pretty cool.
That's a good goal, though. Like, if you can tell a story in 20 seconds.
Yeah. Like, Kugler, I think, is one of the masters at doing the amazing, like, life journey story in 20 to 23 seconds. And I think it's his radio experience that has helped him a lot with that. But you have to remember, too, like, Joel, like, we do a lot of these games, and we're kind of parachuting in a lot of times to some of these things. It's like getting on the plane and trying to find just Googling the player and look at an article from three seasons ago or from high school that his local paper did. And maybe there's one little story or nugget that is mentioned that never got followed up on that maybe in the 3 or 4 minutes you have with them at shoot around, you can ask them about. They're not all going to be gold medal stories, but they're all going to be, you know, if you take the time, everyone that's on the floor has an interesting little tidbit that you can throw into a broadcast.
We talk so much nowadays about developing your personality and your persona as a broadcaster, mm-hmm. Which for you is quite literally a real thing because Alex Reyes is not a real person, but Alex Del Barrio is. And your time with the Globetrotters, like, that's a show. Like, people are buying tickets for a performance. How did, I guess, more so that experience, but your experience in general in those two areas help you figure out who Alex Del Barrio is, the performer broadcaster, as opposed to just being like generic plug and play sportscaster so that you could carve out a spot for yourself?
Yeah, I think the Globetrotter experience, which by the way, I consider my study abroad because I didn't get to study abroad. But that whole experience, I was working with some really gifted entertainers because it's a lot like Broadway in that you're doing the same show every night for the most part. But that doesn't mean it's the same show every night. The show points may get moved around based on the crowd. We may do something we only do a handful of times. Like, we'll do something that's like, we call it Globetrotter football. And we usually do that during the NFL playoffs, right? Especially if we're in a town that features that one of the teams is still alive in the playoffs. Or we'll just like kind of make up something that's in pop culture and we'll talk about it in practice and we'll try to insert it in the show. One of the things, and this happened because I had a great showman in Big Easy, Nate Big Easy Lofton, who's retired now, but he had a great career. And, you know, he's the guy that everyone thinks is like Charles Barkley's little brother because he's from New Orleans and has this amazing personality. He did Amazing Race as well. So he was kind of at another level of famous than the rest of the Globetrotter players that were at the time. He was very giving in terms of letting me be a part of their creative process. Cause a lot of announcers, you're just kind of sit there, you do the show, you play the music whenever they tell you to do it and you just do it. Right. But he was so giving in letting me be a part. He's like, we're a team. We're trying to make everyone here have a good time, smile and laugh. And that freedom allowed me to kind of feel okay with suggesting things, suggesting songs, suggesting sound effects, suggesting things that are on Instagram or YouTube or stuff that people are talking about and trying to find ways to like insert them into the show. So I think just having the creative freedom and just having the person that you're looking up to or that you see as the leader of your show give you that freedom was very important to me kind of developing like who I was, because I was able to try things. Because when you're in some of the smaller venues, right, that's where you try things for the bigger shows at Staples Center and MSG and Dallas, et cetera. But the small shows that are in like these small towns in Oklahoma, or Louisiana, Arkansas, we're still doing a great, fun show. But maybe we're inserting a joke, or we call them reams, into the show that we haven't seen in front of. It's kind of like a stand-up comic, like trying a new joke and seeing if it hits before they put it on their Netflix special. It was kind of the same way with the Globetrotters, just trying to see what we could throw up against the wall and see what eventually stuck. And I think as I've taken that experience, I've been able to kind of figure out, you know, as I've done this TV thing for a few years now, I just finished my fifth season with CBS, like figuring out like what elements of broadcasters that I admire that I want to not copy, but kind of like, we all have like this mixture of our favorite announcers, I think, in us, and that just becomes our style. But there has to be an extra component that's you, that's authentic to you. And I think that experience of having creative freedom allowed me to kind of pinpoint and figure out my voice and where I wanted my energy to exist when I call a big moment in a game.
Did it make you funnier?
Yeah, I think so. I think just being able to feel like I could use my wit, and it's kind of like how you think you're funnier on Twitter, but you're not as funny in real life. Cause like, you know, I don't know, but so I have a little bit of social anxiety and I don't really like to kind of make jokes in group settings and stuff. But when I'm uncomfortable around people, I can be funnier, or I feel like I can say things as jokes, and sometimes they'll hit and sometimes they won't. But that Globetrotter experience, at least from an on-air perspective, I felt like I could be funnier. And then working with guys like Tim Doyle, who we talked about earlier, who is one of our analysts that we both worked with at CBS, like when he's funny, you feel like you can be funny. You still have to be the straight man in, you know, call it down the middle and all that stuff, but you feel like you can make jokes with each other if the portions of the game allow you to have that personality.
Yeah, Tim would actually be a good guy to have on this show. He's a guy that, like, especially I feel like as play-by-play broadcasters, I don't say we all, but I feel like a lot of us get into this and we're like, I'm on national TV now. We are going to be serious and everything is going to be perfect.
Yeah.
And then like Tim sits down, he's like, all right, let's do this. And you're like, what? He's such a great partner.
And his arms are flailing and he says, yeah, something's got to give, you know, like
he something's got to give. Like he's
basically like mini raftery.
Yeah. You know? Like loosens you up so much. Yeah.
And I think that was so important for me. Like, I hate to keep going back to my first game, but that first game was so important to me, Joel. I don't know how it was for you, but that first game for me kind of, in a lot of ways, I feel, and maybe I'm overthinking it, like could have made or broken me in a lot of ways. And if I hadn't worked with someone with a personality like Tim, I'm curious how my development line would have gone if I didn't have someone to kind of open me up. And I still had more room to open up at that point. It wasn't until kind of later on in the year, because you're just trying to stay on the roster, right? You're just trying to like make sure that you get the next assignment. So you've got a lot of jitters kind of going in. But working with someone that is loose and someone that makes you understand that this job is supposed to be fun, that reminder is kind of the most important thing, I think, for me now. Is when I go into a game, I make sure I know we're having fun. It's the fist bumps before you go on the air, say, hey, let's have a good show. Getting on talk back, telling the truck, everybody have fun tonight. Like, that's what this is about. We have a tendency to get way too serious in this. But when you realign that focus and say, all right, we need to tell the stories right. We need to be professional, but that doesn't mean we're not here to have fun. We're very much the toy department of the cable networks, right? So we need to make sure that we're having a fun because the viewers can tell if we're having a good time.
My first game on CBS was with Swin Cash, and I had her sign my board afterward as like, this is my first game. So my analyst signed it. But she's Swin Cash. So I still think to this day, she thought I was just like a huge fan. And I was like, Swin, would you sign my board? Different experience. this is a question we ask a lot of people on this show. Like before every game, I will make a list of things I think my analyst thinks is interesting, things that I think is interesting or are interesting. I want to have like a list of four or five things that I can come back to and touch on throughout the course of a game. One of the last things I do, it's just a me thing, one of the last things I do before we go on the air in like the last half hour is I will write the national rankings in for various teams. Why I don't do that before, I don't know. But like I will put on my board 7th in the Big 12 in offense. That's one of the last things I do. It keeps it fresh in my mind. What are things that you need to do to get yourself ready to go and in the right place when you sit down at the table before a game?
Well, I have ADHD, Joel, so I'm one of these people that like gets to FedEx 2.5 hours before tip off and gets my boards printed because I have to type everything in. I'm just that type of person. So, you know, so these later shootarounds that these coaches are doing now have been absolutely killing my preparation. So I've had to kind of slightly adjust how I prep for those things. And what I've been doing now, I did this year for the first time, is I started bringing kind of like a journal book with me because I wanted to document my opens. I don't necessarily script my opens, but there are points that I want to get in, or maybe a way I want to lead into that opening comment from my analyst that I want to make sure that flows with the rest of, you know, I think sometimes we get too in the weeds about the Open, but I do think that they're important in a lot of ways, because as we progress in this business, the Opens become significantly more important.
And especially at CBS too, because on Sports Network, you guys still do like 3-minute opens.
Right. Yeah. There's still 2.5 on the stools, on the floor. So like, which I think is a lost art, and I wish more networks would go back to it. I tweeted something the other day about the old NBA on NBC. I mean, they used to do a 2-camera stand up on the floor open, where the analyst would look at the play-by-play guy and then turn towards the camera and then go to the graphic. I just watched one from yesterday with Marvin and Matt Kukas, right? And I just think that there's a professionalism to the way we do the Open that I want to make sure that we nail it. Even if it doesn't air, it's important practice for when you're doing it live down the road. So I started making a little journal of like things I wanted to touch on in the Open, and then talk to my analysts before. And you see, CBS has kind of always given me like different analysts, especially ones that they're working with for the first time, because they want them to work with different play-by-play guys. And I always try to find ways to make them comfortable and ask them, what do you want to touch on here at the top? What do you think is important? Because ultimately, like, they can help you set the table for the rest of the game. If you make them feel comfortable early, that camaraderie is going to echo through the rest of the broadcast. So I try to make sure I sit down with them. Hey, what do you want to touch on? And the producer obviously is involved in this as well. But in terms of the opening comment, that's something that's just between the two of us. So how we get there is important to me, that they feel comfortable with the way I get there to them. So that's one. And then in the journal is also where I started writing my shoot around notes, because I know that there may be things in there that I can't get onto my board in time to get them printed. So it's been, but what it's allowed me to do also is, because I'm very bad at documenting my life story, and I really want to start doing that more, because as we've touched on, like, the fact that I worked for the Harlem Globetrotters and visited 26 countries in 2 years, the fact that I accomplished my true childhood dream at being at WWE, the fact that I got to a network, you know, based on kind of pure dumb luck as a result of me getting fired at WWE. like they're like, that story is like wild as well. Like, it's just, I feel like I need to do a better job of like, just when it comes to the point of my career, or my life, that I need to give perspective, being able to go back to something and say, oh, I said this on this night. I need to do a better job at it. And it's something that I will be working on continuously, but that is something that has been very important to me, is this journal book. And I'm going to start just buying a new one every season and saying, this is my 2023-24 CBS year. Right. And then I'll buy a new one next year and kind of do the same thing. And then I have to have my caffeine at the table, 'cause I need that second half jolt. That's the other thing.
What's the go-to?
Usually Mountain Dew, but I'm trying to do the sugar-free thing. Yeah. And so C4 has become my energy drink of choice. I can never finish a full one, but C4 strawberry Starburst is the bee's knees.
Mountain Dew energy, not Kickstart. Energy, sugar-free.
Okay. See, I was
it's
a
hard
huge,
to find now. It
I was
to
a huge.
Prevalent.
Do you remember Amp? It was Mountain Dew Amp.
I do.
So that got me through college, and I realized I was self-medicating my ADHD with Amp in college.
So, funny story. I've told this to some people. I don't think I've ever told it on this podcast. Mountain Dew Energy was in the press box at Ball State for a football game, and I didn't know what it was, and I didn't read labels, and I was like, "Wow, this is good." I had 3 in one game.
Oh my goodness.
It's like 600 milligrams of caffeine.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't go to bed that night. but even better, I was doing the CrossFit games, and there was a booth behind our broadcast position for Yerba. I didn't know what Yerba was. Our stage manager keeps bringing it to us, and I'm like, this tastes great. I had like 6 of them throughout the course of our broadcast day. And by the end of it, I was like, here comes Danny Spiegel. Yeah.
By the way, I blame WWE for the reason I like C4, because they had it for free at their superstore at WrestleMania 38, wherever the last one in Dallas was, because they were just giving it out free. So like that hooked me. So for
you,
the folks,
you could be drinking Woo Energy now.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. Woo energy. Where's that? So the folks at C4 know that your advertising of giving the product away actually works. So for those that out there in the energy drink or soda business, giving away free product actually works.
That's amazing. I want to talk local news with you.
Okay.
Because up until recently, you were doing that. What is it like to balance two lives that way?
Three lives for the last 2 years. It's been three lives.
What's it like to balance three lives?
Yeah.
And what did being a local TV news reporter do for you to make you better at what you ultimately wanted to do?
Well, Joel, I think for a lot of folks, the reason I wanted to get into TV or at least have some TV is because I wanted to do TV play by play. And when I was coming up, you know, I graduated high school in 01. I graduated college in 07, with a little gap year in between of my junior and senior year. And getting on TV to call games was not as, I don't want to say easy, but there weren't as many opportunities then as there certainly are now.
Yeah.
I think we only had two ESPN still at that time and certainly no FS1 and FS2. Sports Network was still CSTV. Just getting on the air to call games was very, very difficult. So radio was the way we got our reps in and got our experience. So the way to transition from radio to TV, you kind of had to get creative and just eventually luck into an opportunity to call games. My luck into it was I was the voice of a D-League team here locally, also doing the local news for a Fox station because one of our owners was also the GM of that station. So that job, we get my first local TV job, right? But we also hosted the G League Showcase 1 year, and those end up on NBA TV and NBA.com, and Turner produces them. So that was like my first chance because the showcase was nearby and they needed a play-by-play guy. I was good enough to get that opportunity, so I did 5 games on NBA TV. And I did them solo, right? But it was my first chance that I got a chance to luck into some TV tape along the way. Now with everyone with TriCasters and the ESPN Plus, ESPN 3 stuff before that, like it became a little bit easier to get TV tape, but that was already 12, 13 years into my career. So when I started doing local TV, it was mostly because it was a way to pay the bills because play-by-play is a part-time enterprise in so many ways, unless you're doing a NBA team's games or you're doing all three sports for a college, et cetera. So it was a way to kind of have, a steady income when I wasn't, doing the play-by-play. The problem is you have to find a television station that's willing to let you go on the road or willing to let you off on certain days to be able to do it. And that's always been the challenge kind of for me, is being able to find a network or a station that's okay with you having multiple things. And it's one of the things that I talk with Ian Eagle, who's been a mentor for me since I started, and especially Andrew Catalan, because Andrew did the local news thing as he was starting his play-by-play career. And they've helped me immensely at trying to understand balance of working for multiple masters, right? And trying to figure out how to keep them all happy and also enrich yourself in terms of opportunities as you can. So the local news thing for me has helped me, one, with my stand-ups, for one, and the on-cameras is just being comfortable looking at a camera while you're trying to have a conversation with your analyst and also present things. Brevity as well, trying to get your thoughts in, quicker and tell a story quicker. And how to, one of the things about play-by-play on TV that's very different from radio is something that we call traffic in our business, right? Is getting from point A to point C with a couple of steps in the middle that include graphics or include a question to your analyst or include a piece of video, et cetera, or a read. And making sure it all kind of flows in the way it's supposed to flow with everyone doing their job at the right time. Local news is a lot like that, except you're in 100% control of all of it, except for the director in the booth, because your producer is not involved with building your segment. The editors that work at the station aren't involved in editing your segment. They're not involved in, the photographers aren't involved in shooting your segment. You're doing it all as a local TV person. And that kind of control is both a blessing and a curse, because you learn how to do everything. But then when you get to a point where you have other people to help you, it giving up that power is sometimes jarring, because you want it to be done a certain way and you've always done it a certain way. And being able to work with other people and trust them to do their job well sometimes is a challenge. But I think the local news thing, for more than anything for me, especially my most recent one here at KRGV, it's the number one station in town by a large margin. And just what my local community here in South Texas means to me, the Rio Grande Valley, you know, born and raised here, I'm 4.5 hours away from San Antonio. I'm 5.5 hours away from Houston, meaning that's the closest NBA team and NFL team to me. Major college is really Austin. You know, we have A&M Corpus, and obviously we have UTRGV here, but in terms of major colleges. So the fact that I've been able to do the things in my career from where I grew up in terms of access, like, is in some ways a minor miracle, because I've been able to find ways to get to those places at different stages of my career when those things weren't readily available to me. An internship with the Spurs or the Astros or whoever was not something that I could do out of high school or even in college, right? It was something that I had to learn about because I didn't know anyone in the business. I didn't grow up in it, or any of those things. It's just something that I wanted to do. And the local news thing in very many ways is a lot like minor league baseball, in that in theory, you start at a small market and you work your way up, double A, triple A. Same thing in local news. I just happen to have done all my local news in my home market. And the only way I'll ever do local news again is in my home market, just because of what my home means to me and what the sports landscape and the sports history here has meant to me. I know it's a long-winded way. I've said multiple things in there, but it's made me better in a lot of ways as I've wanted to transition into TV broadcasting, because being on camera is part of the deal, right? And understanding how traffic works is part of the deal. And those two, when they were married together, of me continuing to do radio play-by-play and doing local TV, gave me at least a mindset that I could turn that into TV play-by-play down the road.
Last thing before I let you go.
Okay.
Give me your best travel story or worst travel story. Just give me a funny story from you having to be on the road.
Do you want a Globetrotter story or?
Well, that's true. We can go to Paris here. It's totally up to you.
Yeah. Best travel story, worst travel story. Do I want to tell that story on a podcast? I don't know.
Now we do. Yeah.
So the thing about being with the Globetrotters is that, especially when you're overseas, is a lot of times you are, kind of on your own, you know, in terms of, you know, it's a very small skeleton group that goes on the road with you. Well, you know, if that means if you want to get in a cab and kind of go somewhere to have a good time because you have a rare off day, you're going to try to enjoy it. There was one time where we were in Italy. We had 3 days off in Rome, which we were kind of staying on the outskirts of Rome, and me and two other folks, we went to the kind of bowling alley, bar, restaurant thing, video game place, and just so we could have an evening, because we had been on the road at that point for 4.5 months. So we were just trying to have a good time. And one of them was our tour manager. Well, his phone died while we were there, and he was the only one that had kind of like international cell phone access.
Which at the time was a thing.
Right. So we were kind of at the mercy of like the venue, like helping us out. Well, none of us spoke Italian. Right. And so trying to figure out how to get back to our hotel, which was, by the way, 25 miles away. So we weren't close. So we had to rely on other patrons at the bar and like ask around to see if we could get back to our hotel. And you know, the trick was, is you had to take a business card from the front desk at the hotel, and then that way you could show it to the cab driver, whoever. So we were showing it to them. Can you take us here? Can you take us here? Well, you know, we get about 15 miles down the road and then the car stops, and they basically like tell us that we got to pay them like $300 each or something like that to continue on the road so we could get back to our hotel. Because and we're in the middle of nowhere, right? So yeah, so I've been,
this is how you wind up on the news, Alex.
I've essentially was been mugged in somewhere on the outskirts of Rome trying to get back to my hotel. That is my worst travel story, right?
That's there. Like Uber before Uber.
Yeah, it was like, yeah,
it's like
it was,
underground Uber.
But it was one of those things where you're reminded that, you know, you need to make better choices when you're in a place that you don't know, and I'm making sure that A, your cell phone stays charged in those situations. So needless to say, we never really went out again. But I could, you know, in terms of great travel stories, I mean, there's countless of them, man. I mean, I was so blessed with the Globetrotter. I got to see the pyramids in Egypt. I got to, you know, go to China multiple times. You know, I've seen the Eiffel Tower, and, you know, I've been all over Europe. It was such a blessing to do. Well, one more quick one. I left a phone on a plane in between Ecuador and Costa Rica and didn't have a phone for an entire like 4-day tour. So I have no pictures of my tour of Costa Rica, which was one of the most beautiful places. It didn't happen. So that was the big bummer right there. But I got a ton of like little ones like that. So, but great. It was a great, great life so far. And basketball in particular has given me so much. And that's why basketball is my first love and one of the things I'll always want to keep doing as my career continues.
Alex, appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Joel.